there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a weekly podcast that can help empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 15 up to 32 years. Each episode, I'll be talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from bullying to climate change, from male violence to ethical behaviour. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. Today on our very first episode, Living Your Life Till Death, I'm talking with the irrepressible Andrew Denton on dying well, something that concerns us all. Because let's face it, death is one of life's certainties. For over 30 years, Andrew Denton has entertained Australians as one of our country's leading television broadcasters and producers. In 2015, Andrew took on an additional life purpose, to be a powerful advocate of voluntary assisted dying. Since then, the organisation he founded, Go Gentle Australia, and his podcast, Better Off Dead, have helped laws be passed in four of our six states. I spoke to Andrew about this journey of his, which has improved the life and death of so many. Hello, Andrew Denton. Thank you so much for coming on. We need to talk about such an important topic, voluntary assisted dying. And when I thought I would like to discuss that, you were the obvious person to contact to talk about it because of all of your wonderful advocacy work around this. And first of all, it might sound like a really basic question, but what is voluntary assisted dying?
That's such a very sensible first question, I think.
Thank you.
Voluntary assisted dying is a law whereby somebody who, in strictly defined circumstances, who is terminally ill and who is dying, after assessment, this is as it's written in Australia, by the way, after assessment by two doctors who found that they have 6 months or less to live, or in the case of a neurodegenerative disease, 12 months or less to live, can be supplied with a lethal medication, which they can choose to take themselves or not at a time that is right for them, mm-hmm. or in certain circumstances where a person can no longer ingest or swallow, then a doctor can administer that lethal substance.
Okay, so it's mostly taken in a substance form orally, is it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. As a drink you mix right. up, but it's not as simple. It's not like mixing up a Milo.
No.
It's a very particular medication. You have to take other medications with it so it will be effective.
Right. And on that, how long does it take to work?
It varies. It can be within 10 minutes. It can be a couple of hours. But usually a person slips into unconsciousness very, very quickly.
Okay, so where are we up to, state by state, in Australia with the voluntary assisted dying laws?
Currently, it's been legal in Victoria for 2 years, in Western Australia for a little over a month. It has been passed as a law but has yet to come into practice in Tasmania and South Australia. Both of those happened in the last 6 months. The Queensland Parliament is due to debate it in September of this year. There's a reasonable prospect it will pass there, but you never know with politics. And that only leaves New South Wales amongst Australia's states. And that will be debated again, I think, here in November. It failed last time to pass the upper house by one vote. And then you have the territory, the Northern Territory and the ACT, who in 1997, Australia became the first country in the world to pass a law for voluntary assisted dying, and it was briefly in the Northern Territory, and it was overturned controversially by the federal government, who used a provision in the Constitution which meant they could overrule a territory's law. So they didn't just overrule that law, they removed the right of the parliaments of the ACT and the Northern Territory even to debate such a law. So there's almost 700,000 Australians told they can't have this conversation.
Oh, wow. That seems very unfair, doesn't it? Is that going to be overturned at some stage, or are people working on the Northern Territory and the ACT to actually have an opportunity to vote?
You bet they are.
Right.
It went to the federal parliament a couple of years ago and was defeated. But I think uniquely in recent Australian history, in the ACT, all three parties, the Greens, the Labor Party and the Liberal Party, signed a joint message to the federal government saying we want our rights back. And the same in the Northern Territory, where the government there is agitating for it. It's not, I mean, yes, it's about assisted dying, but it's much more about democratic equity. And it seems people are shocked when I tell them that that many Australians aren't allowed to decide for themselves what law they should have.
Absolutely. It doesn't sound fair at all. It's up to the federal government to overturn that.
The federal parliament has to overturn it. And, you know, there's, as with many of our parliaments, but there's a strong conservative Christian element sits in our parliament and our federal parliament.
Yes, I have noticed, as a lot of other people have. Yep.
Yes, as they do in our state parliaments. And therein lies the issue. It should be, you know, to show you how ridiculous it is, the Liberal senator for the ACT, Zed Seselja, whose sister, by the way, happens to run one of the leading Catholic anti-VAD groups, he is refusing to vote yes for giving his own territory the right to legislate on this issue.
Oh, wow. Yes, so that has a huge impact on whether it's going to be moving forward quickly or we've got to still
that's
wait.
That's right. So, if I'm a resident of the ACT, I'm thinking, do I really want a guy that isn't prepared to, who's prepared to put his one voice ahead of our 200,000 or 300,000 because that's what he thinks? Is that who I want in a representative? If it was me, I wouldn't, but we'll see what the people at the ACT think.
Yes. So your advocacy work with all of this, voluntary assisted dying, your wonderful podcast, your first series was in 2015, Better Off Dead, which was all about this. At that stage, there was no legislation passed in any of the states. So good on you, because your wonderful podcast, as I've just said, has really made such a difference towards this legislation passing in four of the states. And you're still pushing hard, aren't you, to have the other two states and the territories to have it passed. What was it that made you, I know that your father, Kit, you lost him over 20 years ago and he had quite a terrible last 3 days of his life. What was it that really started you 8 years ago, well, going back probably about 7 years ago now, feeling that you had to make a massive change here? What was it that triggered you then? Was it something that you had been thinking about since your father passed away, that you would take action?
No, I think like many people that have been through a traumatic death, you know, you're in a hospital system, you assume everybody's doing the best they can, and I'm sure they were. And you think, well, that's just how it goes. There's really no one to turn to in that situation. So that was back in 1997. And as a family, we didn't talk about it. We just took that with us and it stayed with us. It wasn't until a couple of things happened at the same time. I moved away from the television industry where I'd done a lot of my work, sold my production company and gave myself time just to think about what I might do. And I'd just turned 50 and I wanted the next part of my life, I wanted to do something which I felt had value as opposed to benefit for myself. But I didn't know what that was going to be. And I've always kept files of things that interest me. And certainly one of them is euthanasia. And around the same time, I read an article by an Australian woman called Margareta Pos, who comes from the Netherlands, where euthanasia has been legal for 20 years. And her dad, Hugo, was dying of cancer. And she described being called back to the Netherlands for his last week before he was going to be euthanized. And what I read about was a highly civilized week where his friends came and did him honor and bade him farewell. and he got all his affairs in order, and his last night was spent with his family, out under the moonlight, listening to his favourite music. He slept well. Everything was said. It was a loving, honourable farewell. And I compared that with what had happened to my father, and that it just set me off on the path. Well, I didn't know much about the politics. Why don't we have that here? And I got very, very lucky. Pretty much at about the same time as I determined to do this, for the first and only time, an international anti-euthanasia convention was held in Adelaide. And okay. The organisers of it very kindly allowed me to attend, even though I made it clear that I wasn't on the same page. But I went along, and I honestly was not steeped in the arguments against, and I didn't know who was going to be in that room. And I spent a fascinating couple of days listening very closely. I took pages and pages of notes to why people opposed this law, and I interviewed a lot of them. And
What year was that, Andrew? Sorry,
that was 2015.
And, oh, okay, right.
And that set me on my path, because I realized I had agreed to give a talk about euthanasia at a public event in Melbourne, and I didn't want to do that quote unquote celebrity thing of you have a cause and you do a few days of research. I thought, if this is big, if I'm going to do this, I should do it properly. So I set off to Europe and North America to speak to people where this law existed. But having this framework of all these arguments against was perfect, because I basically, everywhere I went, I asked their questions. I was told that all these terrible things were being imposed on elderly people in the Netherlands, for instance. So I went to, and people with disabilities in the Netherlands. So I went to their peak groups, and I went through the shopping list. I said, well, is this happening? Is this happening? Is this happening? Is this happening? Anyway, the further I got into it, first of all, I realized that what we were being told was happening overseas was a gross distortion of the reality. Gross distortion, big and little. There's some serious.
Some examples.
Okay. The best example I can give you. At that convention, I met a Canadian man who, as we're speaking today, in fact, is speaking to some New South Wales MPs about why there should be euthanasia. His name is Alex Schadenberg. Mm-hmm. And as with many people I've discovered that most deeply oppose this, if you do a little bit of scratching around, you'll find that he has a deeply Catholic connection.
Oh, yes.
Anyway.
Because a lot of people who are opposed are deeply Catholic or deeply religious. There's an element there that does.
There's a strong connection.
It's conflict for them. Yeah.
Not always, but no. Yes. And it's essentially, in a nutshell, they believe in the sanctity of life from birth through to natural death.
Yep.
For some of them, they have a thing called suffering theology, whereby they believe there is redemption to be had in suffering at the end of life. Mm-hmm. And that it is a powerful tribute to God.
Yes.
And I don't denigrate that belief. I think it's a very important belief for those people.
yes. That's right. The problem happens when they start judging other people who are supporting voluntary assisted dying and trying to actually squash it and say it's not something that should be viable. When the problems happen.
And whether they support laws and medical practice, which means that some people at the end of life suffer terribly, and this is one of their internal justifications. Anyway, so Alex Schadenberg, and I was very new to this, and he was talking to me about in the Netherlands and Belgium, now these laws have come in, that people were being euthanized without their consent, and there was like 1,000 a year, and he had a book. And he said, this is not my words. These are the official reports. I've taken all my information from the official reports. And I asked him, I said, so, because this was completely new to me, and I thought, if this is true, then there is a problem with these laws.
Yeah.
I said to him, is what you're telling me that this is manslaughter or even murder? And he said, manslaughter, murder, it depends how you define it, but yes. So he was alleging directly that about 1,000 people a year were being killed under these laws, were being murdered by doctors.
Oh, wow.
So I took his book. I went to the Netherlands and Belgium. I asked about these cases. I got a lot of information as to why this was not the case from people on the front line. People that ran the Royal Dutch Medical Society, senior physicians in Belgium. But when I came back to Australia, I enlisted the help of a professor at Tasmania, University of Tasmania, Margaret Odlovsky, who was very skilled in the area of health law. And I sent her the book by Alex and I said, can you look at his research here and in your determination, tell me how you think he's reached these conclusions? And I learned a great lesson about the academic world, because she came back and she said, not only have I gone through what he's written, but I went back to all the original documents. And what he's done is he has either cherry-picked little bits of those documents, or he has often stated things that these researchers have said, which is the very opposite of the conclusions they've actually reached. And I was able to put this in a long interview to the person that had run that convention, a man I like called Paul Russell, who was selling the book. And I was able to take him through not just what was alleged in the book he sold, but then I quoted the original research documents, which showed the opposite conclusion. And I asked him to explain how this could be the case. And then I asked him to, was he still selling the book? Mm. And he said, yes, but I'll look at it. And anyway, by the time I had completed that episode of the podcast, which was some months later, he was still selling the book.
Oh, no.
Yes. But, you know, that was an example of, it was fraudulent information. Mm. And I've seen it repeated. I've seen that information repeated and publicised by the Office of the Archbishop of Sydney, the Reverend Anthony Fisher, as recently as a couple of years ago. Mm. I've seen numerous distortions and untruths and clever pieces of cherry-picking repeated by people who, of course, are cloaked in moral probity.
I watched the documentary that you put together. Now, what was that called? It had
Fatal Fraud.
Fatal Fraud. Fantastic. Yes. And that was all about how people are spreading these misconceptions.
Yes.
And we need to be very wary of that. So going back to – so it was around 2015 that you thought, I'm going to be go on a crusade here.
And well, again, I didn't see it as a crusade. I wanted to research a speech I was going to make. And then I decided, as I was recording the interviews, to make a podcast series. It wasn't until I got to Australia. So in Europe and America, I realised that there were a lot of untruths being told about what was happening there. But as I travelled around Australia and began to meet people who had been through or were going through terrible circumstances, I saw equally that there was a ferocity of opposition within large elements of the Australian medical community, many of whom were associated with Christian care and to a large degree Catholic care. And what really upset me and still upsets me was I saw doctors, often senior doctors, effectively saying that the kind of suffering I'd seen my father go through and the far worse cases I had uncovered in my research weren't happening, that there was that medicine could take care of it, that there wasn't a problem, that we have all the drugs necessary to do this. And I did find, and I do find that deeply problematic and deeply disturbing. For senior doctors to say this, they either don't know the truth and so they shouldn't say these things, or they do know the truth and they shouldn't say these things.
Mm. Because it goes against their grain, doesn't it, for a lot of doctors. We're there to keep people alive. And I heard an oncologist speak on a panel that you spoke on at the end of your second series there. And he was saying that a lot of oncologists, palliative care specialists, this is something they don't want to support because it's going against what they believe, why they're doctors. You know, we want to keep people alive. So there is a real issue there. So there's a lot of contention. But the point is, something that I found very interesting is the palliative care most people who choose the voluntary assisted dying have been in palliative care for years. It's not an either or, is it?
No.
It's intertwined. And so it's more of a working together, seeing it as working together rather than an either or. What's your position on that?
Oh, that's exactly right. That's been born overseas as well. You know, whenever I talk to MPs about this, I always explain to them, yes, the legislation is about voluntary assisted dying, but the debate is about better end-of-life care for everyone, and that includes palliative care. All of us who advocate for VAD advocate for more funding for palliative care, more resources. You know, it's the one universal issue, isn't it? We're all going to die.
And oh, yes. Can't get away from that one. No.
And not many of us want to go. There's a fabulous joke, you know, I'd like to die peacefully in my sleep like my father, not screaming in fear like his passengers. I think most of us want to be the one dying peacefully in their sleep. So anyway, yes, the reality is for anyone to access this law, they have to be at the end of a long process of illness. It may not be long in terms of time, but in terms of the journey of the illness, you are terminal. So you've been through a lot of care, and a lot of that can be palliative care. I was very fortunate to spend a week in St. Vincent's palliative care. I'm literally 3 minutes walk away when I was doing the first series. And I think the work of palliative care is really remarkable and perhaps poorly understood, even within the medical profession. And I have huge respect for it. The reality is, though, the palliative care, not only could it not always help people, but people don't always want that help. And I think that's overlooked in this conversation often. There is no medical treatment or service in Australia which is mandatory, nor will there ever be. You have every right to refuse a level of care, including palliative care. And it's one of the things that worries me in this debate is what I refer to as the fetishization of palliative care, and that it becomes this binary. Well, you can't have VAD because you must have palliative care. No, you mustn't. You know, one of the people I spoke to in the second series, a musician who had COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Basically, his capacity to breathe was disappearing to a point where he was going to suffocate to death. And he'd been through palliative care several times, and he said, you know, it would pick me up for a while and then I'd go back down, and it was this endless dance. And he said, that's not how I want to lead my life. And he has every right to say that.
Absolutely, because it's so much about your independence and your quality of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I love what you say about there's so many things that make up each of us, and if we have a terminal illness, imagine those things being stripped away piece by piece, one by one.
Yeah.
And then, and that is so true. And I'd like to just mention, my mother passed away 2 years ago, and it would have been her 90th birthday today, in fact, so it's very apt that we're speaking. And she had a stroke, and she thought, she was a very dynamic woman. She said, I'm not going to end up in a nursing home. I'd rather take that pathway, end of life pathway. So they put the drip up, but it took an excruciating 11 days for mum to pass away. And you're right, she refused IV drips. She said, no, I just want to go out. She also had a comorbid chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and she was dancing to Michael Bublé 5 weeks beforehand at our place for Chrissy. And then she thought, no, I'm not going to go through rehab and end up in a nursing home. And she said, so she took that, she made that decision. And it is really tough, so tough to see. So it was the hardest thing I ever had to do, stay overnight every night with her, because my siblings would come in during the day. But I thought, I just wanted somebody with mum 24 hours in my nursing background. I thought, great, I'll be here. But it was so tough to watch.
Was she conscious for any of those 11 days?
Oh, God, yeah. And this is why she was so brave. She said, could you imagine? She said, no, I choose the morphine infusion and the midazolam, and we had to increase that. And then, of course, some nights I'd said, well, Mum needs a bit of breakthrough because she's got a bit of pain in her neck. And they said, well, we don't want to sedate her too much. And I said, what are you talking about? She's on the end-of-life path. And I had to do a, you know, Shirley MacLaine out of that great film Terms of Endearment, where her daughter was dying, and she came out to the nursing desk and jumped up and down and said, she needs some breakthrough and she's on the end of life path. And there was this confusion and fear in the medical profession and the nursing profession. And yeah.
And look, you have in a nutshell summarized so many people's experience. There is confusion and fear. Mm-hmm. There's no clarity in the law, and more to the point, there's no control for the person who's dying. So your mum took the best option available. And it, you know, when I hear people, doctors, priests say, you know, we have ways of taking care of you at the end of life. One of the arguments put forward is, you know, Paul Keating.
Yes.
Good old Paul. Paul wrote an article back in 2017 when Victoria's Parliament was at the height of debating this, which I've had quoted to me by even a One Nation politician in Western Australia. And one of Paul's thundering arguments was, this is a Rubicon we must never cross. You know, the state should never be taking a life. And I just thought, you know what, Paul, that is bullshit, because we already decided a long time ago it is legal for your mother to do what she did while the nursing people give her mouth care and stand around and support her as she has made a decision to end her life.
Yes.
They are just saying she has to do it slowly and cruelly.
Yes. It was so tough. And I remember the doctor saying, look, Joan, it might take 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And Mum goes, and he walks out, and she said, I'd rather a week. And I'm thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if we could pick a time? And how? And at one stage, I looked up, I'd stayed one night, and about 6 a.m., and she was trying to get out of bed, her legs, and she said, Jane, you've got to get me out of this. And I said, Mum, do you know where you are? And she said, of course I know where I am. Just make it finish, you know.
I knew
what she was saying.
I've heard it so many times, and nobody involved in your mum's case was under any illusion what was happening. She was dying and wished to die, and she was taking a legal course of action to try and make that happen more quickly by refusing to eat and drink.
Yes, that's right.
So the law said she could take that action. All we're really arguing about with voluntary assisted dying is whether or not you can do that quickly and without pain.
Yes,
because the principle that Paul Keating was thundering on about, and I'm going to use the word bullshit again, it's a bullshit argument, because the law recognises that someone can choose to end their own life and be medically assisted to do so, but because it doesn't suit the conscience of some, your mum had to suffer.
Mm, that's it. I wanted to ask you too about the dying alone. Because there's a real fear. I was reading some articles in COVID where people have been dying alone because of the situation, and that really concerned me at the beginning of last year, because I felt, well, we've got plenty of PPE over here in Australia. And I spoke to some not palliative care people, but people who were experts in the infectious disease area, and they said, yeah, look, people can wear PPE and go in. I think Australia's just taking this decision of, oh, no, they've got COVID, they have to die alone, whereas I believe we should have treated each situation separately. But do you think a lot of it is there's this fear too? There is that fear that, and I read an article that said the new fear is not dying, it's dying alone. And do you think that choice of knowing you can have family and friends around you at the time that you choose to die is a big issue, because there is that, if I'm terminally ill, I might die when my family and friends aren't with me. Do you think there's a little bit of that's thrown into the mix, the equation?
I think that, of course, it's in the equation. You know, and even with VAD, people choose their end as suits them. You know, I was told of a man who said a heartbreaking thing. He didn't want his family with him when he took the medication, and his reason was, I don't want their love holding me back.
Oh.
And, you know, a palliative care physician, a lovely woman I met in New Zealand called Libby Smales, who bravely went against her profession to support this law, she said it beautifully. She said, The dying see the suffering of their families as much as the families see theirs. And probably you,
yes,
your mum saw that too. And that in itself is a form of added suffering.
It is. It was right at the end. I'd been with her the whole time. My husband happened to be there as well. And I said, I'm just ducking out to ring my sister. And literally, I said, just let mum's hand be on you. And then he runs into the room and says, oh, I think your mum's gone. And I spoke to a counsellor about it. You know, yes. I had a little bit of counselling about it all because we were soulmates, mum and I. And she said, look, it probably was also, Jane, that she didn't want to let go when you were holding on to her in a way.
Yes.
Because you went out and she was close to my husband, but not the relationship that she and I had.
Not the tactile one, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. It was quite funny because we had an argument over mum's body. I said, why did she let go with you? With your hand holding her, not me. And then the counsellor said, well, that's often the case. The person closest, when they go out of the room,
they feel they can go.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, so, look, I think the vast majority of people that I've read about and have spoken to, the fact that you can be with somebody and it's that intense, dare I say, sacred moment of farewell is hugely powerful. And the fact it's on their terms, the fact that you have, you know, the one of the biggest impediments to people using this law is the objections of their own family. Mm. We don't want you to go.
Yes.
That's the actual coercion that people tend to face.
Interesting, because people were thinking it might be the opposite.
No, it's by far the other way around. We don't want you to go. And that's understandable. We don't want to lose the person we love. So it's different for everybody. I spoke to one family who, and the wife of the man that used VAD is a doctor and she does assess people for VAD. They all understood and supported the husband and father's choice, but once they went through it, they were traumatized and the two children felt they'd done the wrong thing.
Mm.
The wife is still assessing for VAD, but they felt they'd been part of something which wasn't right, even though they accepted their father's choice. So,
interesting.
I remember, and you would know this being a nurse, when I spent that week in St. Vincent's talking to a couple of palliative care nurses at 3 o'clock in the morning, one of them said to me, you know, death doesn't change people. People die as they are. If you've been a bit of a bastard all your life, that's probably how you're going to die. And I think that's very true. Death might simplify your existence because suddenly you're down to the absolute basics, but it doesn't necessarily simplify you.
No, no. And just talking about the stages of death and dying, you're probably familiar with that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross first wrote about in her book in 1969, the different stages. And I'm wondering if people who have choice over when they can go right at the end, whether they get to that level of acceptance, you know, they feel they have that sense of empowerment and control and they can get to that acceptance. My father, just quickly, he died at 62 from bowel cancer and everybody used to pull straws about who would look after Brian Hasler because he was so angry. And I could understand him being so angry, being so young, and he was just, he bit a nurse the day before he died. I mean, yes, he was pretty angry. So he was. But Dad was in a very angry period there. And I'm just wondering, have you done any research into that possibly it helps people go to that acceptance level rather than dying angry or depressed or, you know, they're in a better state?
I would put it slightly differently in that I think to go down this path, you have to have a deep level of acceptance, an acceptance of your reality aside from anything else. Quite early on, the first year I was researching this and I'd done numerous interviews with people who wanted to go down this path, and it suddenly struck me what they had in common, which was a very high IQ. And by that, I don't mean they were smart or educated. I mean intelligence. When you think about it, fear is an emotion, and our most primal fear is dying. Mm-hmm. So to make a decision to accept reality that I am dying and the pathway is such that I don't want to go through the last bit of the pathway. It requires an incredible act of intelligence to override your emotion to go, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go through this difficult assessment process. I'm going to get this medication and I'm going to have to choose the day and then I'm going to have to drink it. All of those things are acts of deep acceptance.
Yes.
And I don't know. It's a very interesting question. I don't know if somebody who was as angry as your father would have been able to transcend his emotions to make those series of choices.
Well, I remember he had a couple of books on euthanasia in his place, but of course 28 years ago.
It wasn't an option,
It wasn't an option.
Having said that, I think on the other hand, were it legally available and he had that medication, having that medication is a hugely powerful thing because you have total control over what happens next. Mm-hmm. You can't control with bowel cancer. I mean, you're always running the risk of a total obstruction and that's the point you never want to be at.
No.
But you have control over everything else. And that may have completely changed your father's attitude because what he may have felt angry about was, beyond the obvious, which is this is what my life has become, is that I can do nothing about what's going to happen to me.
Yes. And he had no choice over, he didn't know how much longer. He was just in Greenwich Hospital becoming more and more emaciated, not knowing when the end would happen.
And was he fully sedated at the end?
No, he wasn't. And I think the reason he bit the nurse was they wanted to get him out for a bath. And I thought, what the hell do you want to get him out for a bath for?
Yeah.
And Dad had bitten her. And he was pretty sedated, though. He was Andrew. And I remember I visited him the day before and I took him an orange and a piece of chocolate. And Dad and I just had this really lovely visit. And he said, hi, Jane. And he was very peaceful.
Yeah.
And my brother rang me that night and said, look, Dad's really confused. He's a bit off at the ferries. And I said, look, I'll come and see him tomorrow. And if something happens in the meantime, I know we had a beautiful visit. But that's why I didn't want to make it. Dad did die at 6 a.m. that next morning. And, wow, it's such a shock when you get that call from the nurse. Mm. It's so final. But I didn't want the same thing happening with Mum where somebody wasn't with her the whole time. Dad had a partner at the time. But she chose not to be with him that time. That's her decision, because a lot of people find it so difficult to sit. It's a vigil. It really is a vigil. And that's why I thought, look, I'll put my hand up here. And I had to do that with Mum. But I can understand my brothers and sister finding it really difficult to do that.
It is. I remember the keeping vigil with my dad and with my mum. And, it's like we have powerful memories in our life, but the memories of my parents dying are in their own place, entirely separate from everything else. Yes. And look, I certainly know from many people I've spoken to that the farewell using VAD has been profound and beautiful. I mean, literally beautiful. That's the word so often used. And one of my favorite examples of that, which is in the podcast, is a man called Phil, Lucky Phil, he called himself. He had a thing called Lynch syndrome, which meant he was genetically predisposed to multiple metastatic cancers.
Oh, dear.
And over 17 years, I described him as like the reverse Cheshire cat, everything taken out of him but his smile. Oh. And at the end, his daughter said he looked like a medical experiment. He had part of his neck and jaw removed.
Oh, dear.
But he still called himself Lucky Phil because he couldn't work out how he'd lived so long. Anyway, at the end, things were so bad. He was on a fentanyl drip and it wasn't touching the sides. And he was desperate. And they used, it's not often used, a provision in the law to hasten the period between his first request and getting the medication because he was suffering so badly. Anyway, all of this, and his last words to his family is he had his wife and his daughter at either side. They were stroking him. His son was with him. And his last words to his family were, be happy.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
How beautiful is that?
And what a way to finish. I've heard this many times over about what that kind of a death has meant. And I've heard the opposite about some truly traumatic, awful deaths through, which should never have happened. And
Sorry, Andrew. I'm just thinking about the checklist that you have to go through. It's a very rigid checklist, isn't it? If so, for instance, Lucky Phil, he was, thank goodness, able to use the voluntary assisted dying. I mean, people at 65, over 65 different safeguards that have to be ticked off before they're approved. Is that right?
That's right. In Victoria's law, 68 safeguards. So to give you an example, first of all, if you're in Victoria and terminally ill and you think this might be the pathway for me, you have to raise it with your doctor. They can't raise it with you.
Mm.
Safeguard number one. So you have to even know about the law and you have to know, oh, I have to raise
it. Wow. So doctors can't bring it up.
No, doctors can't bring it up. Secondly, you have to have a doctor that's prepared to help you. And a doctor may listen to you and go, as has happened in Victoria, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. And by law, they're meant to do that within 7 days, but it's been up to 2 or 3 weeks and doctors have come back and said, no, I can't help you. I can't do this. So you have to find another doctor.
Yes.
And you may have to go through 2 or 3 doctors. You may have to leave your family GP to find a doctor that will help you. You then have to be assessed, fully assessed for your disease, for mental competency, and that doctor has to assess that you have 6 months or less to live. Or 12 months with a neurological disease. If they have any concerns about that, and that could be more so the case with a neurological disease, they must refer you on to someone else who can give you a more accurate prognosis. You then have to find a second doctor who has to be a specialist in your disease to do the same assessment process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of this can take several weeks. So, first of all, you have to make 3 different requests. You have to, first of all, make a verbal request to the first doctor, who's called the coordinating doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Then once you are found eligible, if you still want to go through with it, you have to make a written request in front of witnesses, none of whom stand to benefit from your will or your death in any way at all, that this is your wish, that this is your competent wish, that you are not being coerced, that this is what you want to happen. Then there's a whole lot of other safeguards the doctor has to go through. There are a whole lot of forms that have to be checked. All the details, all the application details have to be absolutely bang on. Even if the a letter is wrong in the surname, they'll send all the forms back and the doctor's got to do them all again. And only then, once all those conditions have been met, can you be issued a permit for the medication? And then when you are ready, you contact the statewide pharmacy service who will bring the medication out to you. But they don't just hand it over to you. They'll sit with you for a couple of hours and they will assess whether they think you're mentally competent, and they've got to take you through who the medication is. You also have to appoint what's called a contact person, somebody who often will help you mix the medication, but whose job it is, if you don't use it, if you die beforehand, to return it safely. So there's a whole lot of things you have to do by law. There's a whole lot of people who are looking at this process, and you are often helped through this almost always by a team of people called care navigators who help you through all the steps of the law. So when it's often put by opponents of this law, it's very easy for someone to be coerced to their deaths using this law. They don't acknowledge or they're unaware of the many, many eyes that are on you as you're going through this process. Whereas prior to this law existing, we know, as happens in New South Wales now where there is no law, in Queensland, doctors illegally assist people to die because they feel they can't leave them suffering. But there's none of that. There's none of that process whereby what doctors are doing is checked, whereby more than one doctor is consulted. There are other things on top of what I've just described, but the process is difficult. You've got to be very determined to go through it.
It almost seems very time-consuming and almost a bit prohibitive. Is there some things you would like to see changed a bit to make it easier, or is it once it's utilised and it does happen quite quickly, does it, all of these
not always
checks?
Not always. So, for instance, I spoke to a family whose I've spoken to a man whose wife had motor neuron disease. It's even more complex if you have a disease like that, because you have to get two doctors to assess you. One has to be a specialist. They have to agree that you have less than 12 months to live.
Oh.
But because it's a neurological disease, you then have to get a second specialist to confirm that prognosis. So in the case of this woman, with the help of their GP, they went to more than 30 neurologists before they would find one that would give that second assessment.
Oh, my goodness.
And it took her 100 days, 6 months, almost 6 months from when she first started. And she was so debilitated by the whole process that when it came to the moment where the doctor was going to inject her because she could no longer swallow, there's a series of medications, one of which is a light anesthetic just to calm, relax you.
Yep.
And that anesthetic is what she died with, that anesthetic, before she was even injected with the lethal medication. So the process had so drained her of her any energy she had. That she died. So something like a third of people that legally get the medication die before they use it.
Oh, really?
Now, some that will be because they decide they don't need it, but others it will be because the process has taken too long.
Right, yeah. So, and I guess some of them get it, and it's just that security blanket that they know is there, for want of a better word, that they can use it if they want. But it's just then they can – it's all about choice, isn't it?
And what is palliation? Palliation is the essence of palliative care is to help people live as well as they can while they're dying. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable mission statement they set themselves. Giving somebody the legal right to have control over what happens at the end of their life is the essence of palliation. It allows them to have control and live as well as they can. They don't have to be thinking about, as people I interviewed before this law existed did, do I illegally import a drug? Mm-hmm. Do I possibly implicate my family in an illegal act? Do I take my own life because I don't feel I have any other legal options here? When do I do this? I can't tell anyone. They don't have to be thinking about those things. They can act in a loving way towards themselves and their own families.
Yes.
They can control this process. They can include the medical profession in it. They don't have to hide it all away.
No,
They
and,
can
and the medical profession can feel comfortable.
That's right. The medical profession. The medical profession can have that conversation without this law. When somebody like your mum comes to a doctor and says, I know what the pathway is. I've had enough. I don't want to go through the last bit. A doctor has very little they can say other than, well, if you want to stop eating and drinking, we'll try and take the best care of you that we can.
That's it. Yeah. How many people have accessed it since it's become legal in Victoria?
In the first 2 years, 224 people, which is very similar to the figures in Oregon. It's statistically, it's less than half of 1% of all the Victorians who died in that time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's for a very small margin of people who choose to use it. Can I just ask, internationally, what's the most progressive country in relation to voluntary assisted dying, or the most progressive countries? Can we learn anything more from some of them?
Netherlands, Belgium and Canada, they came to their laws in different ways. It's probably easier to explain Netherlands and Belgium. In Australia, and in North America, we assess this through a time frame and terminal illness. So we say terminal illness, 6 or 12 months to live.
Yep.
In Europe, they don't do that. They assess it on unbearable and untreatable suffering. And that can, and in a very small number of cases, does extend to people with extreme mental illness. It can, and in a very small number of cases, does, but... And there are very strict conditions for any of these to apply, extend to people with Alzheimer's and dementia. You still have to prove you're mentally competent, however.
And I can understand there's difficulties in relation to the mental, having worked in mental health myself for 10 years, wouldn't be comfortable at all letting it cross over into the mental health realm.
It's interesting. It was the most challenging part of my the research I did for the first podcast series. I spent an intense few days in Belgium speaking to many of their leading psychiatric minds. And I actually did see, I came to understand something I hadn't understood before, which was under their system, the offer of assistance to die to somebody who was, you know, at an extreme level of suffering from mental illness, in fact, extended their life.
Mm-hmm.
Because
really,
they knew that they had, if there was simply no way for them to go anymore, if they felt they could no longer fight, in the case of this young woman, the monster that was inside her own body, that there was somebody there to help them. And so they kept fighting. But that being said, so I came back to Australia thinking, well, I can see, I understand the difficulties with the law. You know, I spoke to a leading psychiatrist over there who looks exactly like Nick Cave. And he's a bit of a rock star psychiatrist, written a very interesting book. And he struggled with euthanasia for people with mental illness, but he said, nonetheless, I've approved too.
Really?
So it's it's definitely
it's very problematic, and I wouldn't I guess also too. I've had some good friends; they've lost two sons in their 20s to suicide.
Yes,
and so I a big area of mine is suicide prevention.
Yes,
so I believe that we should go shouldn't go down the path of the mental area, a mental health area for it. Certainly, physical.
Yes, certainly. I agree. It's a very fraught area. And as I said, I came back to Australia thinking, I can see how this works, but it very quickly became apparent to me. And there have been attempts to pass a similar law like that in Australia. As I began talking to politicians, it very quickly became apparent to me, a society writes a law that reflects society. And those European societies are very different to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. So that's not... I don't think we'll ever have that kind of a law in Australia. No. I do think the question of Alzheimer's and dementia is another question. I personally, I think it's the hardest part of this question because there's such a prevalence. It's the second biggest killer of Australians over the age of 80.
Yes.
I've had it in my extended family. Most people I know have.
Yep.
It's the number one question I get about this. Why doesn't this apply to dementia and Alzheimer's? And the answer I give is twofold. It's one, the core of these laws is you have to be mentally competent and you have to be able to demonstrate that over a period of time.
That's right. And you don't know how long the process will take with dementia and Alzheimer's.
That's right. And the other is almost certainly a doctor would have to administer the medication. And I think that's a very, very difficult thing to ask a doctor to do that to somebody who, even if there's a videotape or an advanced care directive, can they be in their own minds and hearts 100% sure that this is what that person wants at that moment? And so it is problematic. But in the Netherlands, I did spend some time at the clinic that deals with these very specialised requests. And I also spoke to a family whose mother had Alzheimer's and was euthanized. And what became clear to me was, and the man that ran the clinic put it really well, he said, they do it in very rare circumstances and only if that person can demonstrate mental competency. And he said that person has to make a choice to leave the ball before midnight. In other words, to end their life ahead of when they would naturally die, but while they still know what they're doing, or to live their natural life but to drift off into dementia or Alzheimer's. Yeah. So because Australian law says there has to be a determined time, that would never be in prospect here. So I don't have an answer to it, but I do believe it's going to be a question that will be repeatedly asked.
Yes, yeah. Can I ask you, and just getting towards the end of our discussion, death, why do you think it's so difficult for so many people to talk about? And have you seen the Steve Jobs great speech he gave in 2005 at Stanford University graduation ceremony? And he spoke about three things, and one of them was death. And he said, look, you've got to embrace the fact that you're going to die, we're going to die, in order to live best, to make the most of every day. And I don't really like saying personally life short. I prefer saying, because none of us know how long we've got, right? I prefer saying life is precious, life is fragile. We never know when something might happen to us or something might happen to a loved one. So What's your idea around that? Do you think we need to talk about it more, or to have a sense of humour around it? Or what do you think we need to be doing more as a society? Not try and not talk about it, but discuss it more.
I think a sense of humour is advisable in almost all situations. I like John Lennon, you know, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans.
Yes, absolutely.
And there is a magnificent short treatise by the Stoic Seneca on the shortness of life. And he basically says, life is plenty long enough if you know what to do with it. If you set your mind to using your life well, you have all the time in the world. And it's a very, so I ascribe to that. Having said that, despite everything I've done over the last 6 years, I still haven't filled in my advanced care directive. And why is that? Well, I'm not going to die.
Of course you're not, Andrew. No, neither am I.
No, that's right. So, look, every now and then, you know, I'm 61 now, and I'm just entering that stage where people I know are starting to die, and I had heart surgery a few years ago.
Yes. Did that make you feel a little bit more mortal?
No, no. It made me feel incredibly grateful for our medical system. And, I dodged the bullet. I didn't. Yeah. I felt good about that. I think it is good to talk about death, but you think of when you're in your 20s, you're not really talking about this stuff unless it happens around you, unless it happens, impacts on you directly. I'm just saying this in a broad sense. Probably once you pass the 50 mark is a good time to start thinking about how you're going to go and how you'd like it to be. But to me, a bit like you said, thinking about death is to think about life. It's much more to think about what do I want to do? And, you know, that's why I ended up, as it turned out, doing this, because when I turned 50, a friend of mine sent me a lovely thing, which was, you know, the first half of your life asks of you, how am I going to feed myself? What do I need to learn? What do I need to survive? How do I support my family? The second half of your life asks of you, what does your soul want? Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked myself the question, what do I want to do that I think is a value as opposed to a benefit?
And purpose. I don't know if you're familiar with Gordon Livingston. He was a famous psychiatrist, and he wrote a great book called Too Soon Old, Too Late Wise, or something like that. But he said three things we need in life: purpose, something to look forward to, and somebody to love us. And it might just be, and that's not necessarily a partner, but family who love us, who care. And purpose is so important. And you've certainly had a fantastic, you've created, what a wonderful purpose you've created, to be an advocate, such a strong advocate for voluntary assisted dying. And look at the great work. What's happened with it? Are you really, where are you up to now with it? What would you like to see?
Well, Queensland and New South Wales, as I said, remain the outstanding states. They're going to be difficult debates. They always are. Yeah. But I think beyond that, what's become clear from Victoria is that even once the law is passed, there are problems. There are individuals and institutions who obstruct and harass people making this choice. And I think there is a role for the organisation I've set up, Go Gentle.
Yes, I was just going to mention, and I thought, naughty me, I didn't bring it up. Go Gentle Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a health promotion charity, and its first and core goal is to provide more compassionate choices for the people at the end of life, But it's second goal is to promote a much better conversation generally, but particularly within the medical profession, about end of life. It's been an education to me to see how many doctors struggle with the subject of death. I had assumed wrongly that that was something with which they are relatively conversant, but why they should be any more conversant than the next person, I don't know. I mean, we all have to confront our mortality.
Yeah. Absolutely. We certainly do. And we certainly do. And to maintain quality of life for those we're caring for and to understand and look at it way back when I did my nursing training at Manly Hospital, holistic care was what we focused on. And it still is a lot today. And that is looking at the mental, emotional and physical needs of each person.
That's right. Now, I think the phrase now is patient-centered care. And most medical services speak to that, but they don't all practice it. And voluntary assisted dying is the essence of patient-centered care, in that you listen carefully to what that person wants and you don't block them or harass them, because that is their choice. And, you know, I spoke to a fabulous palliative care, senior palliative care nurse in Victoria, who was very angry with me when my first podcast series came out, because, and she wrote a public article. She's a very good communicator, having a go at me mm-hmm. being a celebrity, you know, influencer, whatever. But to her immense credit, she actually checked herself and asked, why am I so angry with this? And she went away and she thought about it. And then over the ensuing years, she spoke to a lot of people, and she's moved entirely her position from one of opposition to strong advocacy for VAD. And she said, I really respect her for this. She said, how can we say that we believe in patient-centered care and we support your choices, except for the one we don't agree with?
Uh-huh. Yes, that's so true. And what a great way to finish our discussion on. Is there anything else that you would like to say about this whole area, Andrew?
Just one thought and one exhortation. If you're in New South Wales or Queensland and you feel strongly about this, then be part of the process of change. Contact your local MP and do it now.
Yep.
Do it personally. Contact their office. You can go to the Go Gentle Australia website. We have a tool where you can very easily find who your local MP is and how to contact them. So be part of the process.
Yep.
And the second thing, I'll just leave you with a quote, one of my favourite quotes about life, which is certainly a driving thought for me, and it's from the philanthropist Albert Schweitzer, mm-hmm. who said, yep. the tragedy is not that a person dies, but what dies within them while they still live.
Yes. Wow. Beautiful. What a way to finish. Thank you so much, Andrew, for your time today, and what an insightful discussion we've had about life and death. You can't get anything that's more important than that. So thank you again, and I'm sure we'll cross paths given our passions down the track.
Thank you, Jane. Really good talking to you.
Next week, I'm talking with Jess Hill about male violence, in particular domestic abuse. Jess is the author of the superbly researched book, See What You Made Me Do. We discuss the issues of shame, humiliated fury, and power, with the main focus being on prevention. I hope you'll tune in, and until then, have a great week, and remember, knowledge is power.